Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. This week, we focus on the latest news from Native American communities in New Mexico and the Southwest. The National Congress of American Indians recently approved a resolution calling for a moratorium on oil and gas drilling in the San Juan Basin in northwest New Mexico. That area includes Chaco Canyon. President Trump approved an extension for this fall for a key program that funds diabetes prevention efforts across Indian country. But the special diabetes program for Indians needs permanent renewed funding for those programs to continue. There are other stories we'll talk about this hour with local Native journalists, from efforts to draw attention to missing Indigenous women to an important Navajo tribal decision this week about a proposed development near the Grand Canyon. We welcome your calls. What's happening in your tribe right now? Is there an issue or news story that affects Native Americans that you think more people should be talking about? Join us by calling 277-5866 or use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM on Twitter. Tara Gatewood is with me this hour. Tara is the host and producer of Native America Calling. That's a national radio show put together here in New Mexico each weekday, and it airs on KUNM. Thanks for being here, Tara.
Sarah, it's my pleasure.
Also, we have Marley Shabala on the phone. Marley's a reporter for the Diné Bureau of the Gallup Independent. Welcome, Marley.
Oh, good morning. Yate bene. Thank you. Yeah.
Tara, let's start with you. What are some of the issues that you hear tribal leaders talking about in the U.S. right now in the new Trump administration?
Well, how long do we have? No. Sarah, I just want to start saying that it is a pleasure to be able to be talking about some of this. And I'm got a little bit of nostalgia going on being back here at KUNM, where Native America Calling started. It's kind of like when you revisit a house you used to live in and you come in and those memories of this place and what it meant to our program. And so I think it's really great to just be here and touch this desk again and see how it's evolved as well, that KUNM is definitely a station that has a very dear place to our program. So I really appreciate being back here and just being in the station again. And the way you began, I think just asking that question, just as journalists, we're always wanting to know, you know, what is the news? What are people thinking about? And then when you put that extra layer of in our tribal communities, that's really important because there is a lot of news that often gets missed when we're covering our Native nations. And so I'm very excited to hear what people have to say when they call in and share. But when we look at this administration and you think about this in terms of a change of administration and because our tribal communities is so woven into this relationship with the federal government. And anytime there's a change of administration, it's tribal leaders learning, reestablishing, building relationships. And a lot of times tribes are wondering, what kind of relationship are we going to have? And so I think that leads to what is on the concerns of a lot of tribal leaders that we are constantly hearing. One of them, economic development. I think our first interaction with President Donald Trump was with his administration. He was sitting there with tribal leaders talking about opening up more resources. And so that is definitely a big buzz of how this administration is going to work with tribes, how far are things going to go. Another is healthcare. And I think we're seeing, along with the rest of the country, understanding what changes in the healthcare, possible changes to what came about. And I think we're going to get deeper into that about healthcare and just understanding more about this. But I think anytime we think about a new administration is to ask those questions as journalists, how much is going to change? How much is going to stay the same? We got budgets coming up, and I know a lot of people are concerned about how will things change? But there's a lot. I think, in general, tribal leaders are still learning. How is this administration going to work with tribes? Especially at the start of the year, one of the first acts that President Donald Trump was to reverse the decision on the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so there's a lot of interesting things right now. A lot of the tribes are just wrapping up elections. And so we have new administrations also in our tribal communities. And so I think what we're going to be seeing as we get close to the end of the year tribal leaders talking about, you know, what they want to see in 2018 in the next 3 years. So it's a really important time.
And for folks who might not be familiar, there were some things that were different about the Obama administration. He visited a tribe. He was the first president to visit a reservation. He had some policies in place to support young people. There was kind of a different conversation. It was a big shift when the new administration came in.
Indeed. And I think, a lot of people are wondering, will some of what we saw with the past administration, will any of it be woven into what we're seeing now? Especially coming off was so involved, especially when we talk about the youth and the initiatives that came out of the White House to bring positive role models or positive engagement for young people, including being active and healthy. And there was a really close tie with that. And we haven't seen that yet. I think something that tribal leaders are also really watching their eye on with this administration are changes in key positions like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as well as the Indian Health Service. And a new person has yet to be confirmed. And I know the dialogue will definitely increase once we start getting closer to that and learning more about who the potential candidates are. So I think that's, something that we're really keeping an eye on.
Yeah. Marley, there was a big story this week. The Navajo Tribal Council killed a proposal. It's been debated for many years to build a tourist attraction on the east rim of the Grand Canyon. Tell us a little bit more about the background of that project.
Well, it was a project, first of all, that did not come from the community. It came from the outside, and instead of even just going to the community and letting the community know, hey, we're going to go over to the main offices in Wind Rock and start getting their support, and so, this is what we're doing. They went straight to Wind Rock, and that was under the former administration of President Ben Shelley and Vice President Rex Lee Jim. And by the way, Rex Lee Jim is running for president. Anyway, the Escalade, that's what it was called, the Grand Canyon Escalade. And it got national attention, international attention, because it was going to be right there on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And there were also other tribes that got involved during the council session, which was on Halloween. The Hopi and Zuni Pueblo came to the council chambers, and they were there to witness the debate, which was 2 hours of debate. And then the council voted 2-16, and so that's it with that legislation and with that project. Well, for that legislation, I'm not sure. Some individuals said that there was still some rumblings going on by the Confluence partners, who were the ones that put that project together, to try to come back and bring it in a different way.
Yeah.
And the council had made all these amendments and told them, you're making the Navajo Nation responsible for police protection. You're also wanting us to foot a $65 million loan. You're also asking for a non-revocable permit. You don't want one of the Navajo Nation Hospitality Enterprise to be taxed, and waiver of Navajo Nation laws. And the council just went down their agreement, the master agreement. But what was interesting about what they were offering, and it was by a former president, Navajo Nation President Albert Hale, who was one part of the Confluence partners. And he was trying to explain the financial benefits, that it was going to bring jobs. And the unemployment in Navajo Nation, is the average is probably about 50%. And so when these outside developers come in, and I think this is true just of Indian country, they come in and they say, we're going to bring you jobs, we'll bring you economic development, you'll have this huge amount of revenue, you can build up your infrastructure, and it's like a light at the end of the tunnel, But they didn't explain, and I had looked at that offer they were trying to make to the tribe, and it was basically a payday loan. Um, if is the tribe, if there weren't enough tourists for 1 year, if they didn't come in, there was a drop in tourism, then that would mean a drop in the revenues, and that would mean a drop in the amount of money that the tribe could pay back. So that would increase the interest rate, and, you know, it's just like a payday loan. If you don't pay your, you know, get your amount paid, then, you know, the interest kicks in double, and it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah, Marley, that Escalade project, it would have been a tram ride and a hotel. It seems like some of the interest, though, might have been in trying to transition away from oil and gas, which has long been the employer. You mentioned that the unemployment rate's really high on the Navajo Nation, but oil and gas was an employer. What else is going on right now at the Navajo Generating Station and making those transitions to other to diversify the economic development on the nation?
Oh, let me just explain about that tram. That was going to be a 1.6-mile gondola tram ride down into the canyon, and then they were going to have this elevated walkway, and it would have been they kept saying, you know, well, we're not going to get near the water, we're not going to do any kind of environmental pollution, and what was interesting is they said it was not a sacred site, and you had the I spoke with the Hopi tribal representatives, and that's their creation place. And there's other tribes that are involved, the Havasupai. So just to let, you know, the listeners understand that. But as far as the Navajo Generating Station, that generating station has been on the Navajo Nation for almost 50 years, and it's a coal-fired generating station. And it is, since it's coal-fired, its only source of coal is from Peabody Coal Mine, which is the Kianta Mine. And the owners of the Navajo Generating Station, which includes the Bureau of Land Management, who keeps saying, no, we're not owners, but, you know, they're listed as such. And it is also the Salt River Project, the Los Angeles Water Utilities Company, and they were they're trying to pull out, and they can't find a buyer. And Las Vegas is in the same boat. They're trying to sell their shares, and nobody wants to buy because they realize that
Marley, are you still there? I think we may have lost Marley and need to get her back. What do you think about what she was just describing, this decision about the Escalade project by the Navajo Tribal Council? Or is there an issue in your community right now that's affecting Native Americans that you think we should talk about today? This is Let's Talk New Mexico, and we're looking at news from Native America. You can give us a call at 277-5866. You can also email letstalknm@kunm.org. We're going to go now to a break, and we'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
KUNM program support provided by not-for-profit Presbyterian Healthcare Services, serving New Mexico and building trust for more than 100 years. More information about Presbyterian and the services they provide at phs.org.
A month after he became a U.S. citizen, composer Igor Stravinsky wrote his symphony in three movements. The New York Philharmonic premiered the piece in 1946. We'll hear a much more recent performance by that same band. Alan Gilbert conducting music by Stravinsky on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
I'm Sarah Gustavus. This is KUNM, and you're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico. Our focus today is news from Native America. Is there a news story in your area that you want to mention right now? Is your tribe taking on a health issue in a new way? Call in now, 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. We're also live tweeting the show. Send us your comments with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. I'd like to bring in now Antonia Gonzalez. Antonia is the anchor and producer of National Native News, a 5-minute newscast that covers indigenous issues across the U.S. and the world. Welcome, Antonia.
Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about healthcare. You and I have been working on a project together about health and wellness initiatives in the Southwest. What are some of the things that have really stuck out to you that's different about efforts today to help people lead healthier lives?
I think part of the series looking at what we've found in California, New Mexico, and Arizona is community efforts and really at the grassroots level. And using technology, I think that health and wellness is, you know, we hear from leaders and people that it's really part of life. I mean, this is part of our lives, and we have to choose to live healthy, healthier. And part of colonization has changed the way that we do things, the food we eat, and the way that, you know, that we're raised. So it's really neat to see different people taking action at the local level and also incorporating different aspects using, you know, healthcare services, using different programs. But I think that it's really neat to see individual people taking charge and leading charge of their health. For example, in our series focusing on people helping others with working out, with nutrition. And I think that's really part of what's going on, not only in the Southwest, but we see that in other communities across the country.
We'll listen to a story in just a moment, but can you explain to folks who might not be familiar, when you say colonization changed how people eat, what does that look like in Native communities?
So if you go to any reservation border town or a lot of reservations, there's a lot of fast food. There's a lot of unhealthy options. We hear about food deserts where there are not a lot of options for people to get fresh fruits and vegetables. A lot of people don't engage in hunting anymore. So, you know, they're relying on packaged processed foods instead of traditional foods that from their gardens, from hunting, from gathering. And so that's really had an impact and really shown in statistics when we look at diseases of diabetes, obesity, heart disease. And so that colonization with European settlers coming in has really changed the diets and the way of life of people on reservations across the country. And so we're seeing different efforts in tribal communities to go back to harvesting. And we're going to feature in some of our upcoming stories some of the practices that people are revitalizing and going back to.
And some of the youth, it's really exciting to hear them talking about traditional foods as well. Let's go now to Gallup. We spoke with Lauren Anthony, who does meal prep and helps other people find ways to work out with the community. We talked with him about why this is important to him.
Lauren Anthony prepares chicken, cutting them up in his kitchen, making sure to get them as lean as possible before throwing them on the grill at his house in Gallup, New Mexico.
If you don't prepare for your week as far as eating clean, then majority of the time you're going to go pull off into some like fast food joint.
The Navajo actor, health advocate, and motivational speaker has been doing meal preparation for about 7 years. It started as a way to improve his health. He now offers them up to the public to purchase. High-calorie processed foods can be found at every corner in Gallup, Lauren says. Gallup is a town where people from the Navajo Reservation and Zuni Pueblo often go shopping.
I want our community to be healthy because there's so many people out there just struggling with their health issues. And I think the real health care plans are, you know, at home.
Food deserts are common on many reservations and surrounding areas. Those are places which lack access to fresh, healthy food. But health professionals say people can work with what's available.
It's not always about the best option, but what's the better option than what you have now and making the best of what you have.
Heidi Gabalski is a nutritionist at the Native Americans for Community Action's Wellness Center in Flagstaff, Arizona. She says some of her clients often have to pick foods from a convenience store or from federal commodity boxes.
Let's say there's the fruit cocktail. Rinse it as much as you can because it's in heavy syrup. You know, we've got flour and things like that. Do we have to fry it? Could we make dry bread instead of fry bread? Drinking water instead of soda? But soda's a big issue.
But
back in New Mexico, on Lauren Anthony's menu is grilled chicken, rice, and green beans. This meal is under 400 calories compared to fast food options, which can add up to 800 or more.
We don't go and hunt and gather anymore like we used to. You know, we would go out and build a fire, and there's work put into that.
Healthy living has not always been the story for Lauren. He says he changed in 2009 after living a life he describes as drinking alcohol, being overweight, and depressed. Lauren says after reaching a low point, he decided to turn his physical and mental health around, which eventually led him to help people today with both their diets and physical health. On this day, he volunteered to team build with the girls' high school volleyball team.
He's a support that a lot of these kids need.
Lorena Morris is the girls' head varsity coach at Gallup High School.
There's a lot of challenges facing a lot of the youth, especially due to how widespread the area is. A lot of kids have transportation issues. A lot of kids have financial issues. A lot of them live in poverty. And what I really like about Lauren is he does not charge for his services.
Lauren says his passion for helping people stems from overcoming many challenges in his life.
I don't want people to give up. And I believe that when I speak to youth, when I speak to young adults, when I even speak to our elders, we can always pick it up and say, I want to be that leader.
Researchers and health professionals say consistency in eating and a strong support system are associated with long-term success, which Lauren and other grassroots leaders are striving for in Indian Country.
And that was Antonia Gonzalez from National Native News. We also have Tara Gatewood from Native America calling with us. Tara, your reactions to that story, do you see the same things in your reporting on health issues in Indian Country?
Yes, and I'm glad to see that we are living in a day where we are really taking a closer look at, as mentioned, food deserts and food that is available and how it is leading to what we're seeing in our communities. And we're also seeing an emergence of Native chefs or people who are, okay, we see what the problem is. Well, what can we do to fix it? And a lot of them are taking on the initiative of returning to traditional foods and, you know, also just getting in the garden, getting in the dirt and starting to grow some of this. And so when we see these kind of reports, it's exciting to see that there are people like Lauren who are concerned about this and are doing something about it. And something that struck my interest as I was hearing that, I was thinking of something that I was learning about this summer and with the Nota Begay 3 Foundation, which is simply NB3, and they're rolling out an initiative too that actually started yesterday. They're calling it the 0 to 60 Challenge, where they're challenging tribes and communities to cut out sugary drinks. And I was talking with one of the folks from there, Justin Heeneman from the Navajo Nation, and he was just talking about how this was brainstormed of thinking of in our communities that sodas or sugary drinks have become a staple, and there's so much of it going on that the idea was to challenge people to go to zero sugary drinks to 60 ounces of water. And so that challenge has been thrown out. It's going from November 1st to the 30th. And then something to also improve fitness among young people. November 5th through the 11th, they're having the National Week of Native Youth Health and Fitness. And it's really exciting. We had a chance to look into this on Native America Calling before and take a look at what communities were doing to bring youth to the table to think about their fitness and their health. And so it's great to see that, you know, we're in another year of this and people are posting events that they're having, either health walks or just spreading knowledge of how to be healthy in the community. And so I think of 20 years ago with the fight against diabetes in our communities, and a lot of it was advocacy work or poster drives and things like that. And to think of two decades of people working to fight diabetes in our community, we've come a long way. And it's really exciting to see the youth being woven into this, because before it was more geared towards adults and talking about adulthood obesity. And now we're thinking of, okay, well, this goes, you know, the kids are watching, they're seeing, they're eating the same things. And this is also happening to our youth. And so to see how much has evolved and to hear stories like this and see the Nota Begay Foundation having initiatives like this, things are changing. And I think that's something that we can celebrate. And often we hear that on our program and people are calling in and seeing some of those changes.
At that grassroots level where it's not coming from Indian Health Service, it's not coming from the government, it's people picking that up and saying, this is what I can do, like Lauren Anthony. This is something I can do for myself. I can share that knowledge with other people in my community.
And I think also something with this initiative of showing what Native communities are doing, it also brings that unity among our nations. A lot of times unity comes in different ways, but if people are starting to unite because of health reasons and changing how they see and the foods that they're eating. I think it's establishing a stronger community. So it's exciting to see some of this.
Absolutely. Do you relate to these issues as a New Mexican? Do you see the same things happening in your community in New Mexico? Are you relating to what we've shared about health responses to health issues in Native tribes in the Southwest? Give us a call, 277-5866, or email letstalknm@kunm.org. Antonia, let's bring you back in. The Special Diabetes Program for Indians funds prevention efforts in many communities. Where does funding for the program stand right now? It's been a little uncertain in recent months.
So the Special Diabetes Program funding was set to expire at the end of September, but President Trump did extend it, and it was part of a larger bill where funding will continue through December. And so tribal leaders across the country, health advocates, Native organizations have been working and advocating on Capitol Hill for this funding. A lot of programs across the country rely on this funding. One of the stories that we featured on fitness, a lot of their funding comes from this program. And so a lot of people are looking to get this funding continuing through the Trump administration. And to add to what Tara was talking about with the water, that goes in line with our series tomorrow, which we'll be looking at an initiative, which is part of an NB3 initiative, Water First, and a school in Flagstaff, Arizona, that's not only looking at drinking water, but also improving water quality for nearby communities on the Navajo Nation. So you have to tune in to our programs tomorrow to hear that story.
Give us a little preview of what's going on with access to water on the Navajo Nation right now.
So for generations, Navajo people have been hauling water, and Marley can probably speak to this as well. But, you know, my family, my grandmother on the reservation, for years visiting her with no indoor plumbing. And so people today still haul water for cooking and cleaning and livestock in the communities near Flagstaff at the Star School, which we were at with this water initiative. They're looking to improve water quality through a big yellow 70-passenger school bus, which is most of the seats are taken out, and now it's retrofitted with a filtration system, and it's gonna it has the capacity to filter about 500 gallons of water per day. And so students are really involved in this. Young students, it's pre-K through 12th grade. And so students have had a chance to go on the bus and learn about filtration. And so not only are they addressing the bad taste and smell of well water, but also trying to take out some of the contamination in the wells there. The Navajo Nation was a key place for uranium mining, and both federal and tribal studies have shown that there's been an impact to water sources across Navajo land. And so looking at drinking water, as you know, a lot of community members that we spoke with say that they don't trust the water and they won't drink the water for many reasons. And so also access to, you know, buying water. We heard from people that soda is just cheaper to buy than to buy a bottle of water. So that's going to be our featured story tomorrow on National Native News.
And Marley Shabala from the Gallup Independent, this is kind of an ongoing issue. Sometimes these things don't make the headlines in the news, but is this an issue that you've been covering, access to water, projects to try to increase access across the Navajo Nation? Marley, are you there? Looks like we're having a little bit of trouble with Marley's line. We'll get her back again. Let's do a little pivot here to another issue in Indian country. It's been 1 year since many people, including folks from New Mexico, traveled to Standing Rock to support opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. It's now up and running, as Tara Gatewood from Native America Calling mentioned earlier this hour. One of the first actions taken by the Trump administration was to reverse the hold on that pipeline. Tara, what do you think is the lasting impact of those protests over the pipeline, especially for tribes here in New Mexico? It wasn't just about what was happening near Standing Rock.
Sarah, I think, you know, for the next 10 years, we're probably going to see how much impact this had on our tribal nations. And I think what we're seeing is this understanding of voices being heard. And you constantly hear that as more people reflect a year later October 27th was a very big date there in the camps of people remembering and some of the camp that they had set up and intersection with the law enforcement. And so it's interesting to just see people's memories coming forward as the year progresses and as we get closer to the winter. And December 4th is another critical day that happened. But I think connections right here to New Mexico, we're seeing a lot of people still reference what happened there in Standing Rock, or as you know, it is often not phrased, the prayer camps that were near there. And you know, that area of Standing Rock is important to different tribes there. And so anytime I refer to it, I call you know, the area near the Standing Rock Reservation, because there's a lot of different nations that have that place as a sacred place. But I think here in New Mexico, there were a lot of Native Americans from the Pueblos, from the communities, Navajo Nation, that made that journey there. And something that we hear when we talk to folks who did make that journey, that it made them think about what they needed to do when they came back home and issues that we face here in New Mexico. It was interesting to see how much of that inspiration from what individuals learned by going to these areas came out during the Entrada that happened in Santa Fe, and just talking about sovereignty and asserting sovereignty, or either just making it known these places have indigenous ties. And I think that's a dialogue that has definitely started by Santa Fe and the reenactment that goes there. We also are seeing people who are relating to the fight with Chaco Canyon and what is going on there, and seeing this as a struggle here in our own communities. But I think there's a lot that we continue to see reflections, and it is. I got to go back to that. This is a year of reflection to see just how much of this is playing out in our own local communities. And it's something that we hear from any tribal nation across the U.S. And another lasting effort with what's going on with what happened there in North Dakota is the divestment campaign. And so we're constantly seeing in social media people who are working to bring the divestment campaign of encouraging people to take their money out of some of these banks or institutions that are funding some of these pipelines. And so it's really interesting to see how people in New Mexico are reflecting to some of this. But it has definitely, I think the biggest message is indigenous people understanding our voice is heard. And it's that next question. Okay, well then now what? And I think a lot of people are asking some of that.
Now what? Antonia Gonzalez from National Native News, you traveled also to Standing Rock to report on the water protectors. What do you think about the impact 1 year later?
Yeah, so for sure, not only, you know, traveling there, but just doing a lot of reporting here locally. It was this time of the year, and for months, different demonstrations across New Mexico. We covered several here in Albuquerque at the University of New Mexico. There were, you know, many demonstrations in front of campus. There was a large demonstration over at U.S. government offices in November last year. And a lot of people, like Tara said, talking about Chaco Canyon. And I think just recognizing the struggles that their communities are facing, and connecting it to the Standing Rock people and the Standing Rock movement. There were people across the country, a lot of people here in New Mexico who maybe they couldn't travel there, but they were showing their support by going to these demonstrations and also sending items. There were a lot of people who were gathering and sending items. And like Tara said, the prayer camps, there were people who were holding events here in New Mexico, different prayer events. And that was always part of the demonstrations as well, was connecting that. And so traveling there a year later, you see all these, the movement, you know, which was youth-led. It's important to look and talk about youth who really started the movement, running from North Dakota in the spring to Washington, D.C., that really sparked what was happening and getting international supporters. And so looking at different movements across the country that are going on now, there's still different demonstrations. People are looking at different pipeline issues, different environmental issues, and connecting it back to this was, you know, sparked from Standing Rock.
And Marley Shabala, what do you see in discussions about proposed drilling near Chaco Canyon? Are people making that connection between what happened in Standing Rock and the opposition to drilling near Chaco today?
There were actually some water protectors that came into the region to be with a group of community members, and the community members are elders, young adults, and families. And they were there to show their support. So they understood the why people were saying that water is life, because unlike the more developed areas, which you see in the metropolitan areas, the reservations or Indian country has always had issues with infrastructure, especially water lines and power lines. And then you also have this history of this strong, very, very strong connection to the land, because it just goes to, this is Indian country is the homeland of the first communities here. And so they're not nomadic, no matter what any researchers may report. The people have their very much what, when they say homeland, it is their homeland. You can ask anyone, any of us that are talking right now, where are you from? And we are going to tell you exactly where we're from. And unlike, you know, sometimes I'll ask my friends, non-Native friends, where are you from? And they'll say, well, we're from Albuquerque. And I said, well, you were born and raised there? And they'll say, no, we were, you know, we came from New York, or, you know, we came from California. And then it's like, well, but originally, where are you from? And some of them will know originally, you know, we're originally from Germany, or we came from England. But some of them, they don't, but we do. And so that is what ties us to the land and to the water itself. And so everyone, water is life. And that's so simple in that statement that people don't really get it until they don't have that water. And so you have the people, the indigenous people living in areas where there's water and they're not going to move. So once it's contaminated, they're going to have to haul in their water. And it costs water now, you know, a dollar. Right? How much is water now? Probably about $2, almost $3. And a lot of these communities, they don't have that economic development and they have high unemployment. Plus, we use the water in our ceremony. Every ceremony, I'm Navajo and Zuni. My father comes from the Pueblo of Zuni. My mom comes from actually that area that is near Chaco Canyon. It's a small community called Lake Valley, New Mexico. And in every ceremony, indigenous ceremony, you will see water. You will see the herbs, you will see the foods, you will be sitting on the ground, you're not sitting in a chair, and so you have to use that in your ceremonies. And now there are many tribes that are having ceremonies for the water because they've they accept the responsibility that the humans have polluted and made the water unhealthy, and it's part of the food cycle, just what was being talked about as far as healthy foods. If your water is polluted, and no matter how much you're drinking to try to be healthy, you're ending up getting yourself very sick, and that's what happened with uranium. And that's true up in the country of Standing Rock. The Lakotas, they had to go through the contamination of uranium, and more people understand what happened here on Navajo because of the publicity. And it goes back to this show and providing this opening for Indian country to let people know what is happening here, because you're not going to ever see it on national TV. Some of it will get into the New York Times or some of these large media outlets if there's confrontation. But otherwise, you know, they're not going to cover it. It's sad, but a lot of the national media simply believe in if it bleeds, it leads. Mm. And so when you try to explain to them about the water and this huge history that goes there, that is tied into it, intertwined into it, it's difficult for them to understand. And I feel as if they don't want to write about it because it has to do with religion, but it's about spirituality. And actually, I went to a workshop, and there was this huge discussion of why reporters don't fully tell, or they don't tell the full story about what's happening in Indian country when you have the individuals talking about the land and creation, and that water is a sacred being, the land is a sacred being, the air is a sacred being, the fire is a sacred being, because they showed that actually many of the journalists were atheists. So there was this conflict, and I was sitting there thinking, we're actually censoring our own news by not putting in the full story.
Marley,
and so people, yeah.
I want to get more into that, into doing journalism and some of the other issues with that in just a moment. We need to take a very quick break. We'll be right back. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We're talking about the top news stories in Native American communities in the Southwest. The number to call today, 877-899-5866, or email letstalk@kunm.org.
It's not every day you have a car to donate. In fact, it may be once in a lifetime. But when the time comes, do yourself and KUNM a favor. Donate it to keep great programs like this one on the air. If you itemize deductions, you'll get a sizable tax deduction, plus we'll give you a KUNM membership as our thanks for your special gift. Because it is special to donate your longtime car or truck. When you're ready, call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
I'm Tara Gatewood, host of Native America Calling. More than a month after Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico, most people there are still without electricity. Many still don't have clean water. On our next hour, we'll lend an ear to hear what Taino people have to say about the recovery and rebuilding of Puerto Rico.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Sarah Gustavus. This is Let's Talk New Mexico, and we do have the host of Native America Calling, Tara Gatewood, with us this hour. Also, Antonia Gonzalez from National Native News and Marley Shabala from the Gallup Independent. Marley, you just shared a lot of important points about place, about water, about spirituality, and how journalists are approaching covering Native communities. And there's something different about Native journalists covering their own communities. I read a recent Reporter's Notebook essay by a colleague of yours, Arlissa Bacenti, corralling the press won't stop us from doing our job. She mentioned working alongside you and some of the challenges getting access to government officials. Do you feel like the situation's changed in 2017? Is it more difficult to get tribal officials to talk to you on record for your stories?
It is. And in Indian country itself, and this is sad, disappointing, and but Indian country is has learned very well from Washington D.C. politicians about how to control the people by withholding information, and any journalist would understand that. That's why the media journalism was created, was to keep an eye on government. And in Indian country, and this has to go with how the history of Indian country and its relationship with the federal government. And when councils were created, and I'm not saying that there wasn't any government before the federal government or European came over, it has to do with how that history is being told. So when for the Navajo Nation, In any of the governments or any of the tribes, Pueblos, Alaska Natives, we had our own government, and we had our own law, we had our own math, we had science, we had our hospitals, but it was all through our own way. So when the corporations came over, and this was after the U.S. Geological Survey had gone through Indian country and found where the natural resources were, minerals, they gave that information to the corporations, and they came to Navajo Nation. And they came to the eastern part of the Navajo Nation, and it was oil and gas that they wanted up in the Shiprock area. And the people there told them they didn't want that when they came to them. And they asked them, actually, and this was the first environmental impact statement, because when I read that history, the people asked them the questions that you will find in the environmental impact statements. What are you going to be doing? How is this going to impact the air, the land, the water, the people that are living there? And, you know, what are you going to leave behind? So after they explained what they were going to be doing, and the people said, no, we don't want it. And they said, well, you know, we'll give you money. And at that time, the people were very self-sufficient. We hadn't, we were making our own clothing, you know, producing our own food. Our water was clean. We had our own transportation. We were very healthy. If we didn't have a horse, we ran to where we needed to go. And so they said, you know, what are we going to do with that paper? You know, we don't need it. And so they tried to go to all the other people, but our government was, you know, your area of land, you have your say in that area of land. This group over here has their say in their area of land, their little homeland. And so they kept going to all the people, and each of them said, this is not happening in our little area. You have to go back over there and talk to those people. So after getting rejected, they ran back to Washington and said, those Indians don't know what's good for them. You need to teach them. They don't even have a government. You know, they're still living in poverty. And it was the non-native definition of poverty. So they bring back the federal government. And the federal government says, okay, we're going to create a government for you. You don't have one. And so they created a clone of what is going on in Washington, D.C. And they handpicked the first council, Navajo Nation Council. And then they had the Bureau of Indian Affairs representatives sit there to make sure that the Navajo Nation Council did what was good for them. And the reason I'm telling that history is because when you go to Washington, D.C. and try to get any information from any of those federal agencies, what do? They send you to their public information officer. And so what's happening in Washington, D.C. happens here on Navajo. It happens throughout Indian country. And Navajo Nation, under the administration of former Chairman Peter McDonald, he was the one that kicked out the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Bureau of Indian Affairs representative was sitting there and telling the council, you can't do this, you can't do that. And Chairman Peter McDonald got up and said, you do not tell us what to do. Who are you? You're our trustee. All you do is sit there and watch us, and that's it. You witness it. We are the Navajo Nation, and we will make these decisions. We are adults. We're educated. We no longer need you. And so they started turning the tide then to break away, but still you have these laws that are created that are the clone of the federal government in Washington, D.C. to withhold information. And you know it's been a fight nationally for journalists. And then now you have within not just Indian country, but nationally, they're finding out that corporations now own these huge media companies, and they're trying to control the TV stations and the airwaves. And they understand that power of information. And so within Indian country, there's a way to get that information. It takes a lot more work, and it's slow, but you have to educate and let them understand. And it's sad because, it again, goes back to this history of trauma and control. And it has to do with trying to help the people, the leadership, remember we always had an open government. And when I get asked by our own council members, why are you airing our dirty laundry, Marley? And some of them are even related by clan to me. And they'll say, you know, you're my mom, you're my sister, you're my aunt. Why are you doing this, auntie? Why are you doing this, mom? Why are you doing this, little sister? And then I'll tell them a story about how, as our clan, we would get together and there would be one person selected, and that person would say what is happening within the clan, the good news and also the news that was negative. And if it was negative news, and no matter how terrible it was, incest or a sexual assault, that would be told and the people would know, because they understood that when something like that happened within the community, it would affect everyone. And those kind of understandings of sexual assault and rape and incest were finally recognized not too long ago. Instead of closing the door on it, they've realized how that impact is a huge ripple effect. And the same was said within Indian communities. Because our ceremonies involve not only the family, but that family is connected to the entire community and how it affects it. So you would have to understand how or what was going on in that community. And there would be celebrations, ceremonial celebrations for what's happening and achievement, and then also for something negative, because the community needed to heal. And so I would tell that story. And the councilman would understand. I wouldn't have to say, so that's why we have to have an open government, you know, add that to it, you know, or that's why you need to give me this legislation, or you shouldn't, you know, call a executive session. They would understand that this is something, this is part of how we, our government was. We had an open government. And so they, you know, they listen to the story, and I'll end the story, and then they'll just say, okay, well, thank you, Marley. Yeah, you too. You know, you have a good day.
Right. And Marley, that view of an indigenous view of journalism and government is so important. I want to give Tara Gatewood from Native America Calling just 1 minute to kind of wrap up your thoughts on the importance of journalism today, right now, with all these big issues. We only covered a small part of it in this hour, but what's the role of journalists moving forward?
Keep working. I think that's it, is just keep pushing forward. And I think it's really exciting that you ask that question to Marley, just thinking of the history with the Navajo Times and thinking back again several decades of what the Navajo Times was doing to continue to cover some of this. And Marley, definitely, when you're going to write your book, but you understand what it means. And I think something that we often share with other journalists is sometimes it can be a challenge to talk to tribal leaders, and making this relationship so that the news is covered, definitely turning to them. But I think the future, looking forward, we must continue to cover the stories, ask great questions. It's the same formula from the beginning: critical questions and coverage.
And we will definitely be bringing you guys back again, following your work and making sure that we are raising that awareness of those issues in our Native communities here in New Mexico. Thank you all for being here today. The conversation doesn't have to end here. Use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM on Twitter, or go to KUNM.org, where you can leave your comments and share the show with people you know. We also posted links for the panelists we heard today. If you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Rashad Mahmood screened your calls. Sarah Trujillo produced today. And Victor Onimole did live tweeting. Elaine Baumgartel is the executive producer. This is Let's Talk New Mexico.